From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, John Paul Vann and the Vietnam War. Vann was a U.S. officer who fought on two fronts, on the battlefield against the North Vietnamese and in staff meetings against America's military policies during the war. His obsession with winning in Vietnam is the subject of a new book by my guest Neil Sheehan, the reporter who brought the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times. Also today we talk with Marty Jones. Relatively few people are familiar with this singer-songwriter's work, but many of those who have heard her call Marty Jones one of the best voices in rock. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead gives his views on the new movie Bird, and television critic David Bianculli reviews Roseanne, the new sitcom starring self-proclaimed domestic goddess Roseanne Barr. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Journalist Neil Sheehan has spent the better part of the last 26 years trying to learn the truth about America's involvement in Vietnam. Sheehan first covered Vietnam in 1962 for UPI. 2 years later, he joined the New York Times. In 1971, Daniel Ellsberg gave Sheehan a smuggled copy of the Pentagon Papers, a top-secret history of the war, commissioned by Robert McNamara. Sheehan brought it to the Times. The Times published it. The Pentagon Papers were an invaluable source for Sheehan's new book, an 800-page history of the war in Vietnam, focusing on the life of Lieutenant Colonel John Paul Vann. According to Sheehan, Vann's military influence made him the third most important American in Vietnam. Vann first went there in 1963. His efforts to expose corruption in the South Vietnamese Army made him something of a renegade within the military and a hero to the press. Vann retired from the military in 1963, then returned to Vietnam as a civilian in 1965 to head the pacification program. In 1971, he was placed in charge of all military and civilian operations in central Vietnam, an unprecedented appointment for a civilian. Sheehan writes, "Vann saw much that was wrong with the war, but he could never bring himself to conclude that the war itself was wrong and unwinnable." John Paul Vann died in Vietnam in a helicopter crash in 1972. By the end, he had become a victim of his own self-delusions, and Sheehan thinks his story parallels the story of America's military involvement in Vietnam. Sheehan's new book is called A Bright Shining Lie. I asked Neil Sheehan if he was motivated to write this book by a sense of anger at having been misled and deceived as a reporter covering the war in Vietnam.
It was less out of being out of anger. It was more out of a sense that I wanted to leave something behind other than another magazine article or another newspaper story. I'd spent all of my career covering the war, first in Vietnam and then covering the Washington end. I never managed to escape the war. I went there in 62 as a young reporter on my first assignment, and I got the Pentagon Papers for the Times in 1971. And then found myself at John Vann's funeral in 1972, and going to the funeral lit a candle in a way for me. And so I decided to write a book about him, because I thought through him I could tell the story of the war.
Why did he seem like the right person to choose as the subject to tell the story of the war?
Well, the idea came to me at the funeral. I went because John had been my friend. I'd met him in 62 when I first went to Vietnam. And when he was killed, I went to the funeral at Arlington, and it was like being at a strange class reunion. This chapel was filled with about 300 people, and there were all the faces of Vietnam, and this man had brought all of these people together. William Westmoreland was his chief pallbearer, the chief pallbearer of a man who had originally left the Army as a renegade lieutenant colonel, and then went back to Vietnam as a civilian and became our first civilian general. And Edward Kennedy came in a few minutes before the ceremony started, and I thought right away that the last of the Kennedys, his brother, set the country to war. And over on the right was Daniel Ellsberg sitting with the family, who had been Vann's best friend, and they'd both gone in opposite directions on the war. And I had the feeling that we were burying more than John Vann. We were burying an era, that whole era of boundless self-confidence that had led us to the war.
You arrived in Vietnam as a reporter for UPI in 1962. You were one of about 12 full-time correspondents who were there. And you describe yourself and the other reporters who were there as wanting to see America win the war as badly as the lieutenant colonels in the military did.
That's correct, because, you see, we all shared the same outlook in that generation. It was the outlook, what's now called the outlook of the Cold War. All of those beliefs that, first of all, let's remember that America was at the high noon of its power then. And we were also at the high noon of our outlook, in what was really, in retrospect, a naive outlook on ourselves and on the world. We believed that, first of all, anything we wanted to do was innately right and good, and secondly, that we would succeed at it. It was that outlook that had really been brought on by World War II, the success in World War II, and then the confrontation of the Cold War. So that the young reporters shared with the advisors in the field, the senior ones generally tended to be lieutenant colonels down through captains and lieutenants, that same outlook that they did. We thought our country ought to be in Vietnam, and we thought we should win this war, and we thought we would win it if we fought it the right way.
You found that one of your best military sources as a reporter in Vietnam in the early 1960s was John Paul Vann, the subject of your new book. And especially after the Battle of Ap Bac in 1963, he was, you thought, exceptionally honest and didn't hold back how discouraging he found the defeat there to be. The American troops lost 5 helicopters. They were trampled, and he didn't conceal his anger or the extent of the debacle from the reporters.
That's right, because by the time Ap Bac occurred, the frustration had been building in John. He had been sent there to help this South Vietnamese army win its war, and these people didn't want to fight. The leadership didn't want to fight. And they got in this battle with a Viet Cong battalion, and he drove them to try to overcome them, and they wouldn't. And he was furious because he'd been reporting this kind of thing to his superiors in Saigon, and they wouldn't listen to him. They wouldn't, and the South Vietnamese leadership wouldn't change its habits, and he finally just exploded with rage and then really began to talk to the reporters, who by that time knew him well because we'd been out in many operations with him and his advisors in previous months.
There were things that he was just learning that he was up against. For instance, he hadn't realized that Diem, who the head of South Vietnam, had discouraged the South Vietnamese army, from conducting offensive operations that would result in serious casualties because he was afraid of a coup in his country.
That's right, and because Diem saw his army not as a force to crush the communists, which the Americans saw it as, to crush the communist guerrillas, but rather as a force, in the last analysis, to keep him in power. He assumed that if he could hold on to the major cities, if worse came to worse, the United States would send its army to rescue him. And so he did not want to risk his regular army, and he did not want his commanders to take casualties. Unfortunately, our own commanding general in Saigon refused to believe this and was quite naive about the whole thing. When he went to see Diem, Diem said, oh, certainly he had ordered his people to take casualties, to fight offensively, but he hadn't at all.
And John Paul Vann was just learning at this time that he had a lot less control over the South Vietnamese army than he thought he did.
That's right. He was beginning to learn the extent of the limitations that Americans faced in Vietnam. But Vann was a man who reflected all those qualities we admired in ourselves then, and defeat, accepting defeat, was something he couldn't do.
Well, there's interactions that you described that he had with one of the military leaders in the South Vietnamese army named Cao. Am I pronouncing that
yes,
right?
Yes, that's right.
And so Vann would hold daily briefings with Cao, basically to build his ego, not to really have a joint leadership of the troops, but to make him feel good so that then he would feel like he was in on the decisions, even though Vann would be telling the troops what to do. And why don't you describe the kind of briefing room that Cao had arranged for these sessions?
Well, he had this extraordinary, it was an attempt to imitate Napoleon's map room. And he had, the walls were covered with maps, and he had this podium at the end of it where the briefer would stand, or the commander would stand to give instructions to his officers. And what Vann was trying to do was to manipulate Cao. He thought that if he got Cao to behave as he called it, like the tiger of South Vietnam, that eventually Cao would begin to act the part. But Cao, unfortunately, declined to act the part when it really came down to it. That is, when he got in battle and Vann wanted him to actually close with the guerrillas and fight, he would never do it. But Vann believed in that kind of thing, that there was a bestseller of that era called The Ugly American that had as one of its heroes Edward Lansdale, the famous CIA agent who'd worked in the Philippines. And Americans had the idea that you could manipulate foreigners then into doing whatever you wanted them to do if you could somehow find the key, and Van was trying to do this with Cao. Cao manipulated Van in many ways in the end.
My guest is Neil Sheen, and he's just written a new book called A Bright Shining Lie, John Paul Van and America in Vietnam. This book is 16 years in the making. Sheehan was a journalist in Vietnam in the early 1960s, and he also obtained the Pentagon Papers for the New York Times. Van knew the Army had to be restructured in order for America to have a military victory in Vietnam. And he tried to, you think now that he tried to use the reporters, especially David Halberstam as the New York Times, as a way to send his message to Kennedy and to the Pentagon, who followed the New York Times very closely and knew how influential it was.
Well, John thought that, first of all, his own commanding general in South Vietnam would listen to him, and he was trying to get out the truth about the war, and he believed that he could get it out through the reporters. And Halberstam happened to be then, of course, the correspondent for the Times, and obviously had the best audience. The New York Times attracted the most attention in Washington when a dispatch was published in it, and so he concentrated on David. But he assumed, as we all assumed, that the American system in that period was rational, that if you got the facts out, those at the top, the president and those around him, would take action to change things. As it turned out, the American system by the 1960s wasn't rational. It would not accept bad news and would not react to facts. It simply would go on and persist with its own preconceptions. But John was under the illusion that it would. We were too. We reporters believed the same thing. But unfortunately, no one realized then the extent to which our military and political leadership was really deluded.
What was a briefing with Van like?
Well, John had a brilliant mind with this extraordinary analytical capacity, and he could go right to the heart of a matter. And let me give you an example. The advisors would other advisors, the advisors in general, would point out to you that the United States was in fact arming the Viet Cong guerrillas in South Vietnam by giving the militia on the Saigon side good new American weapons that were considerably more advanced than the bolt-action French rifles the guerrillas were using that they'd inherited from the French War. What John would do is to sit you down and say, look, I have 716, don't hold me to that precise number, but he'd have a precise number, outposts in my division zone, and we're putting X number of weapons into them every month, and we're losing them at this rate, and look, we're building a formidable enemy out there. He would give you precise information, which over a period of time enabled you to really analyze the situation and changed the reporting, not only to make it more informative in terms of the facts that were in it, but it became qualitatively different. It was better reporting, and he was really the one who was behind that. He was the one who taught us that.
In 1963, when his tour of duty was up, he retired, and the reporters were so grateful to him for his honesty with them that they gave him a little send-off. They gave him an engraved ashtray that said, John Van, good soldier, good friend. And in the send-off, David Halberstam thanked him, and he said, every time we cabled a story, we worried about hurting your career. And then you say, John Paul Van said in response, you never hurt me any more than I wanted to be hurt. And those words have much more significance to you now, having uncovered some of the things that you did about John Paul Van's past. He couldn't possibly have gotten promoted to a higher rank than he had already held as lieutenant colonel.
Well, he could have gone to colonel, but not to general. And that's what counted for him, to him.
And this was a secret. Tell why he couldn't.
Well, he had a dark sexual side, which I discovered after I began to write the book, that had come really out of his childhood. He had pulled himself up by sheer force of will from a childhood of extreme poverty and degradation in Norfolk, Virginia, and from a mother who rejected him and left great psychic scars on him. And he turned out to have this, as I said, dark sexual side, and had been almost prosecuted, almost court-martialed for statutory rape because of an affair with a 15-year-old babysitter. Now, none of us, and so this had really put a black mark on his military career. He would have made colonel, but he would not have made general because the Army would not have promoted a man like that to general officer. And so he actually was going to retire. We did not know that. We thought he was constantly risking his career. The fascinating thing about the man was that he did have moral courage. So you have this mixture of a man who was deceiving because he knew his Army career was over, but at the same time, who did have moral courage. He might have taken on the commanding general. It's a might have been, we'll never know. But it added this extra dimension to him, which fascinated me and was one of the reasons why I found him a much more interesting character when I started to write the book than I ever realized I would be, than I ever realized he would be.
Well, even at this point where you thought, so here was someone finally really being honest with the press corps, his motives weren't completely honest.
Well, John is always a mixture of motives. And I think his motives in being honest with us were honest. That is, he really did want to get out the truth about the war because he went back to Washington and briefed the Joint Chiefs of Staff, started a campaign at the Pentagon. The question was that, in retrospect, was his willingness to take risks. we thought he was risking his career because he was taking on the commanding general. It turned out he didn't have a career left to risk because he was not going to ever make general officer. That was the rub. The question of moral courage is that he did have it, but he was also deceiving us.
After Lieutenant Colonel John Paul Vann left Vietnam as a military man, he returned as a civilian. And I want to talk with you about that chapter of his life after we take a short break. My guest is journalist Neil Sheehan. His new book about John Paul Vann is titled A Bright Shining Lie. Sheehan reported from Vietnam in the early 1960s for UPI and later for the New York Times. In 1971, Sheehan obtained the Pentagon Papers for the Times. 16 years ago, he took a leave of absence from the Times to begin writing this book about John Paul Vann. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Journalist Neil Sheehan is my guest, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, A Bright Shining Lie, John Paul Vann and America in Vietnam. John Paul Vann returned to Vietnam as a civilian in 1965, and he was with the Agency for International Development's Pacification Program. What exactly was his job?
Well, he started out as a province representative for AID, which had the main responsibility for the civilian pacification program. He went to work in the most dangerous province, in fact, in the Saigon area, a place called Hau Nia, west of Saigon. And he gradually rose up through the system till he finally ended up as really our first civilian general. He was on detail to the Army and a corps commander. He commanded a corps region, the mountains and the central coast, before he was killed in June of 1972.
Did he become more corrupt in this second round in Vietnam?
Well, what happened to John was one of the tragedies of Vietnam. He was a complicated man, and that made him more fascinating to me because he was even more symbolic of the American venture in Vietnam with all of its contradictions and complexities. But what happened to him was that he couldn't give up the war. he had up to Tet 68, which was the surprise communist offensive that broke the will of the American public to continue the war. He had up to then managed to maintain a sense of reality about the war because he kept his professional honesty in one compartment of his life and this private side of his, which was full of deceits, in another compartment. But after Tet, when the country turned against the war, John couldn't give up on the war. He then began to rationalize the reasons why we should continue in Vietnam and came up were these ideas that were incorporated into the Vietnamization program under Nixon, and then he began to lose his compass and to lose his grip. And when he died, he was really fighting for this kind of illusions that had led us to Vietnam in the first place.
Why do you think that a man who understood some of the problems of corruption and loss of control among the South Vietnamese Army, and one of the first people to petition the American government to try to reform the way the war was being fought, why do you think he was so intent on continuing with the war when America was beginning to lose militarily?
Well, you see, first of all, he was a marvelous soldier who was most at home in war. That satisfied him emotionally more than anything else. He tried working as a defense a business executive for a while at home, was terribly bored with it, went back to Vietnam. For John, war was the most fulfilling thing he could do. Nothing was boring. Everything was important. Everything was urgent. And then he had this personal side of him, which he could satisfy in Vietnam in a way he could never do in the United States. And so the war gradually, and also he invested his own career in the war. Everyone else went to Vietnam for 1 year or 2 years or 3 years. John went, and he stayed over the better part of 10 years. And by the time 68 came along, he had invested so much of himself in the war, he couldn't give up on it. So he began to rationalize and say that, well, we could win through this Vietnamization program, that is, by turning things over to the South Vietnamese while we withdrew the Americans. It was an illusion. But that's what finally destroyed him. I think the personal needs, the war met his professional and his personal needs so much that he couldn't give up on it, and so it finally devoured him. And that was one of the tragedies of Vietnam, but also, to me, one of the fascinating things about the man. Because you see, when I decided to write this book, what I wanted to do was to write a book that would tell what really happened in Vietnam and why it happened. And I wanted to do it in a way that Americans would accept. That is, they would read it because it was a story told through the life of a man whose life was really a novel. And Van was that figure to me. He had summed up the war, and yet he summed it up in a fascinating way that I thought would help the American reader to come to grips with the war because they would see it in human terms.
Your two major sources, your two most important sources for this book were John Paul Van's papers, which you had access to, and the Pentagon Papers, the papers that you had brought to the New York Times for publication. In the Pentagon Papers, what were there one or two most important things that you learned from it that helped inform this book and your overview of the war?
Well, the Pentagon Papers remain the best official archive of official documents, and still is the best archive of official documents that we've come up with on the war. And what the Pentagon Papers were useful to me for was a concrete evidence of this delusion under which the American military and political leadership was operating, because the Pentagon Papers are their memoranda, their telegrams, their messages, that is, the messages of the generals and the statesmen of this country. And so they were invaluable to me. John's papers were enormously invaluable because he kept pretty good papers over the years. They tended to be spotty at points, but he kept some marvelous stuff, which gave you insights into important historic moments in the war. Go ahead.
When Daniel Ellsberg offered to leak the Pentagon Papers to you, did you have any doubts about having them published? Did you fear that this would be perhaps an unpatriotic act and that it would damage America's credibility? Did you have any of those fears or doubts?
Oh, no, I didn't. And this is without getting into the whole business of news sources. That's another story I've never gotten into. But I had no fears that these papers were going to endanger the security of the United States. There were no military secrets in those papers. They were filled with political and historical secrets, which would make a lot of people angry who had held senior positions in this country. But those papers belonged to the American public, and they were the record of the war. The public had a right to those papers. I mean, the American public had paid for those papers with their lives of their sons and with the treasure of this country. And I had no qualms whatsoever. I think that was true of others at the New York Times who were involved in the whole thing. We felt those papers belonged to the public and had to be published.
What were the consequences you feel you had to face for publication of it? Any harassment or consequences to your journalistic career?
Well, Richard Nixon was quite unhappy over the whole thing and didn't want to prosecute the publisher of the New York Times, but they thought for a while they would prosecute a reporter. And they got a grand jury going and investigated me for quite a while, for 6 months or so, and sent FBI agents around to question my neighbors and subpoena my checking accounts. And it kept me, it ate up my life for 6 months. I spent every day talking to the lawyers, and then they finally gave up. It just sort of melted away.
Was it hard for you to be a practicing journalist after you became the man who got access to the Pentagon Papers?
No, I had trouble in the period in which they were investigating me, and I was having my time taken up talking to the lawyers about what the latest move the Nixon administration had made. But I didn't have trouble with military sources, for instance, if that's what you mean, because mm-hmm. I had always maintain my credibility as a journalist by keeping whatever I wrote in the news column separate from my own opinions, and had been very rigorous about that. And I think people I knew understood that, and they continued to see me and accept and talk to me.
This is perhaps an absurd question, but if you knew then what you knew now, if you had more information when you were covering the war, how would you have covered it differently? Do you think you would have been allowed to?
I wouldn't have been allowed to. You know, quite recently, he was the deputy ambassador in Saigon. It's called Deputy Chief of Mission in the State Department. Officialese came up to me and said, "Oh, God, why didn't we know this in 1960 or 61 or 62 or 63? And I said, "Bill, if we had, you would have been fired you'd lost your job if you had tried to make people believe it. And I certainly would not have been able to write it as a journalist. You would have been fired as a subversive." I was awfully glad when I was a young UPI reporter in Vietnam, writing things that contradicted what the generals were saying, that I had belonged to the Republican Club at Harvard. You have to remember that was an era in which when you questioned authority, you were immediately suspect. And if we had really known the things about Vietnam we know now and had questioned the wisdom of the United States being there at all, I don't think you could have practiced journalism. We didn't know, and our ignorance was to some extent a professional protection.
Where do you go now? You've spent most of your professional life writing about the war in Vietnam in one way or another, 16 years spent researching your new book. Is the war behind you now, or are you ready for a brand new subject?
I don't really know what I'm going to do next. I'm at peace with myself. I set out to try to put the war in perspective for myself and for my country. And I've done the best I can in this book to tell what happened in Vietnam, what really happened there, and why it happened. And I'll go on now and do something. What I'll do, I don't really know. Right now I'm busy with the publication of it, but I've always stayed busy all my life, and I'm sure I'll find plenty to do.
There were many surprises for you along the way writing this book. If you could sum up for us, and I know this is an impossible thing to ask, what the greatest change has been for you in your understanding of the war?
I came away with it realizing that there was a great sense of inevitability about the war, that given the political and military leadership of this country in the post-World War II period, we were destined to fight that tragic war in Vietnam, and a tragedy for ourselves and for the people of Indochina. When you look at the men involved, the men who made the decisions, and their view of the world, you realize that they wouldn't have done anything else other than what they did, because they rejected alternative courses when they were offered to them.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
My guest has been Neil Sheehan, and his new book, A Bright Shining Lie, John Paul Vann and America in Vietnam, is published by Random House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with singer-songwriter and pianist Randy Newman, who has his first new album in years. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Rock singer Marty Jones writes some of her own songs, but she thinks of herself primarily as an interpreter. Her latest album features songs by John Hiatt, Janice Ian, and Jackie DeShannon. Coming up, Marty Jones tells us about her solo career since she gave up being the chick singer with the band. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Bird, the film based on the life of jazz great Charlie Parker, and TV critic David Bianculli reviews Roseanne, the new sitcom starring stand-up comic Roseanne Barr. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Michael Dukakis today lashed out at George Bush for failing to spell out his policies. He told workers in Ohio that the vice president is like a television game show host, letting the voters guess what's behind door number one, door number two, and door number three. During a news conference yesterday, Bush repeatedly refused to lay out his budget priorities and said he would not do so until after November 8th if he's elected president. Bush today attacked Dukakis' defense program, calling the Massachusetts governor uncomfortable with anything related to our nuclear arsenal. Bush stressed his willingness to continue pumping more money into defense programs. Details from NPR's Phyllis Crockett.
The Martin Marietta plant in Denver, where Bush spoke, is the home of the Titan missile. Bush said he would modernize the country's land-based missile systems. He said he doubted that Dukakis would. And Bush said he would go forward with SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative.
Now I'm determined to press ahead. I will not leave America defenseless against ballistic missiles.
Bush said he did agree with Dukakis that defense procurement practices needed reform. The country must spend efficiently and make tough choices. For a solution, Bush suggested moving to a two-year budget system and multiple-year funding for major weapon systems, and eliminating what he called unnecessary layers of senior and middle management in the defense bureaucracy. I'm Phyllis Crockett with the Bush campaign in Skokie, Illinois.
Georgia Congressman Pat Swindle was indicted today on charges of perjury for allegedly lying to a federal grand jury. The 10-count indictment stems from Swindle's testimony about a sting operation in which a federal agent posed as a money launderer. The Republican from suburban Atlanta's 4th District says he will seek a speedy trial so that he can clear his name before the November election. Swindle is up for re-election against Democrat Ben Jones, a former actor on television's Dukes of Hazzard. The U.S. government might ease some of its sanctions against North Korea. The move is likely to be discussed when South Korea's President No Tae-woo meets with President Reagan and Secretary of State Shultz on Thursday. More from NPR's Ted Clark.
U.S. officials say no final decision has been made and that any easing of sanctions will require careful consultation with South Korea. But South Korea has been urging the U.S. and other nations to ease restrictions against North Korea to improve the climate for North-South talks on the Korean Peninsula. Preliminary talks have already taken place. State Department spokesman Charles Redmond said North Korea's recent good behavior is another reason that sanctions might be eased.
In view of the fact that the Seoul Olympics passed without disruption by North Korea, and that now there is dialogue between the two Koreas, resuming at Panmunjom, we are reviewing our policy toward North Korea.
Redmond would not specify which sanctions might be relaxed, but when the U.S. has warmed toward North Korea in the past, it's taken relatively minor steps, such as easing travel restrictions and allowing U.S. diplomats to have substantive discussions with North Korean diplomats. The U.S. does not have formal diplomatic ties with North Korea. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The United States and the Philippines signed a new agreement today that will permit the U.S. to operate its Philippine bases for two more years. In return, the State Department has promised to try to gain congressional and presidential approval of nearly $1 billion in new aid to the islands in 1990 and 1991. The current bases agreement, signed in 1947, must be renegotiated if an American military presence is to continue in the Philippines beyond 1991. Stock prices were slightly higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 7 points to close at 2140.47. Advances led decline 6-7 on volume of 119 million shares. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead believes that most Hollywood movies about jazz and jazz musicians are so full of nonsense and misinformation that you can only enjoy them with low expectations about their accuracy. Kevin recently saw Clint Eastwood's film Bird about alto saxophonist and jazz visionary Charlie Parker. He says that while the film does a good job with the historical details, it misses an important part of the big picture.
Watching director Clint Eastwood's film Bird, I was constantly amazed by how much it gets right. Just about every major event in the film is based on an actual incident from the life of Charlie Parker. Obviously, a lot of people did a lot of homework. Of course, Charlie Parker made the filmmaker's job easy. Bird's career was so full of larger-than-life stories and outrageous exploits, all Eastwood and writer Joel Oleansky had to do was decide which stories to include. The complexity of Parker the man comes across whole. The boyish and overweight Forrest Whitaker isn't just physically perfect for the part of Bird. He's got down the nuances of his character as they survive in the historical record. The instant mood swings, the mock British accent he'd affect to put people on, his charm and wit and self-destructiveness. Parker's excesses are the stuff of legend, and the movie Bird is about the places where fact and legend intersect. Images in the film echo famous jazz photographs and film clips. Some published interviews with trumpeter Red Rodney have been transformed into screen dialogue. Never mind that the real Red Rodney seems quite unlike actor Michael Zellniker's portrayal. Even the movie's loopy, non-chronological structure seems patterned after Bob Reisner's oral history book, Bird, The Legend of Charlie Parker. The film touches on and keeps returning to most of the aspects of the Parker legend. His ambivalence toward the heroin to which he was addicted, his complicated relationship with that smart survivor, Dizzy Gillespie, and the irresistible pull between the struggling Parker and socialite Chan Richardson, who later became his wife. Oddly enough, there's only one aspect of Bird lore the film doesn't make much of, his music. Bird tells an audience everything about Charlie Parker except why he's worth celebrating in the first place. In Bird, discussion of Parker's music always seems just around the corner and just out of reach. Like in this scene where Chan Parker, played by Diane Venora, tries to explain to an unsympathetic psychiatrist why her husband shouldn't undergo electroshock treatment.
We're talking about a very special, creative man. His livelihood depends on his ability to improvise and compose music. See, that's not just dexterity. That's from being a...
Mrs. Parker, do you want a musician or a husband?
Look, they do not separate.
But in Bird, the two do separate. We see more of Charlie Parker, the loving but exasperating husband, than of Parker, the bebop revolutionary. As presented in the film, Parker's music seems alternately hyperactive and achingly sensitive. Those are facets of his style, but they don't get at the paradox that makes him so fascinating. Charlie Parker's life was a mess, but his art was as close to perfect as art gets. His improvised solos have the high order and clarity of a Bach fugue. Their formal elegance and harmonic sophistication set a new standard for soloists. But the movie Bird doesn't connect his alto style with the larger musical revolution waged by him and Dizzy Gillespie and other important musicians like Max Roach who aren't portrayed in the film. Miloš Forman's movie Amadeus may have trashed the life of Mozart, but at least it connected that life with his art, admittedly in a superficial way. Wolfie Mozart wrote happy music when he was happy and sad music when he was sad. Charlie Parker wasn't that simple. He'd be nodding off from a heroin fix one minute and improvising an inspired solo the next. One of Hollywood's best jazz films is Martin Scorsese's underrated New York, New York, because it dealt explicitly with those contradictions between one's art and personality and showed how those contradictory sides fit together. The singer, played by Liza Minnelli, was sweet and sympathetic, but the musicals that she starred in were awful. She was too eager to please. Robert De Niro's saxophone player was a jerk, but he was stubborn enough to keep playing good music. Scorsese used the couple to define the conflict between entertainment and art. Clint Eastwood's Bird never gets that far into its subject. It's curious that Eastwood should let us down, given how skillfully he pulls off the rest of the project, and considering how much trouble he went through to incorporate actual Charlie Parker solos into the soundtrack. By the way, Forrest Whitaker doesn't do as good a job of fingering the sax as some critics think, but that's a quibble. You might have heard about how the movie's music was put together. Parker's solos were electronically stripped from their backing tracks, and then a newly recorded rhythm section was added. As Eastwood and music director Lenny Niehaus have explained, they needed to enhance Parker's original music and bring it up to contemporary standards, lest the archaic means of reproduction prove too distracting for today's audiences. Of course, in Hollywood, they have a name for that sort of thing. It's called colorization. By spiffing up the rhythm section and leaving Bird's sound untouched, everybody else sounds bright and clean, but Parker's alto sounds like it's stuffed with cotton. His searing tone loses most of its presence. It's as if the Philistines who colorized the Maltese Falcon had left Bogart in black and white as a tribute to his greatness. Divorced from the movie's images, this colorized bebop sounds pretty atrocious. The sound of Charlie Parker's saxophone, swamped under reverb-heavy drums and an obviously amplified bass, is sort of a metaphor for the movie Bird itself. Despite the best of intentions, Parker's music gets buried under all the fancy effects.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence magazines. This is Fresh Air. In the years since the Beatles, singers who aren't also songwriters have become something of an anachronism. Marty Jones is one of the few rock singers who admits to often preferring the songs of other singer-songwriters, such as Elvis Costello, Marshall Crenshaw, and John Hiatt, to her own. Jones has made three records produced by her partner, guitarist Don Dixon. She's hoping that her latest album, Used Guitars, will have the commercial breakthrough that has eluded her. She's never made it to the Billboard charts, although she's a favorite among critics and college students. On Used Guitars, there are three songs Marty Jones co-wrote with Don Dixon, including this one, Tourist Town. Jones wrote the lyrics and is featured on vocals and acoustic guitar.
I'm tempted to hide away. I'm tempted to hide in a tourist town.
You co-wrote several of the songs on your latest record, but I think you actually think of yourself more as a singer than a singer-songwriter. Is that right?
I'm not really. I've never been a songwriter first, and I just never got in the habit of doing my own songs, not in public anyway. So I never really developed as a songwriter, and I'm just starting to really get back into it with the help of Don Dixon coaxing me along, saying, Marty, you know, you really can write. And he cringes when he hears me say that I'm not really a songwriter.
You do two songs by Janice Ian on your new record, mm-hmm. and a lot of people remember her as the singer-songwriter behind Society's Child. I had no idea what she was doing. How did you come about getting songs from her? Tell me about Keep Me in the Dark.
She's been writing in the past 2.5 years with a woman named Kai Fleming. So actually the two of them wrote Keep Me in the Dark, and it was a song that they had in the stockpile when we all three got together. So I said, well, you know, I really don't feel this pressure to have to come up with new songs. Why don't you guys play me some things that nobody else wants to do of yours, things that you like, things that you think I'd like. And then they played me Keep Me in the Dark, and I really loved it. So that was one that I chose.
If you don't love me, if you don't need me, I don't want to know. Keep pretending you're not leaving till it's time to go. I'm not asking for forever, baby. That's more.
I find that, particularly with pop songs, that sometimes songs will really grow on you, and a song that might not really strike you one way or another the first time you hear it will become a really wonderful song after you've heard it 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times. So I'd really like to know how you judge a song, if you can judge it on first hearing, or do you have to listen to it a few times, play it around in your mind a few times before you know whether you really think it's a good song or not?
Sometimes I listen to songs and I'll get tapes, and they hit me as songs that I really love. What I can't figure out is how it's gonna sound with me doing it, or how am I gonna approach the song. The Real One is a real good example by John Hiatt. I got a demo of that song a couple of years ago and put it in the pile marked really great songs but maybe aren't right for me right now. And Dixon, being the dedicated producer that he is, made me stick with it and heard something in his head, and he knew it could be strong, and I really do love the way that song turned out. The other John Hiatt song is also a good example of that. I've had that tape for 4 years, the demo tape of If I Can Love Somebody. And it was, when it was first sent to me, this girl was singing it, and I don't know who it is. She has a beautiful voice, but it was with a piano, and it was just real ballad type. It sounded like Heart Like a Wheel by Linda Ronstadt. And I thought, you know, I can't do this song like this because it's going to sound like Heart Like a Wheel by Linda Ronstadt. So it took me a while to go back to that and just figure out some way to do it. And lo and behold, it was sort of this Taj Mahal approach that came out of me, because I'm a big Taj Mahal fan. Even John said, after he heard my version, he said, "Gosh, I can't believe how you changed that song." I said, "Well, I mean, do you hate it?" He said, "No, it's just when I wrote it, I wanted everybody to feel really sorry for me." But it just didn't sound sad to me. It never did.
The smiling ghost who left me here is laughing in the wind. The tables all the turning, all their backs on me again. But I'll get out alive if I can just hold on till then. If I can love some. If I can love somebody, if I can love somebody like you.
Before you started recording solo, you played and recorded with a band called Color Me Gone. When that band broke up, did you not want to return to singing with a band again?
Once I quit that band, there were maybe 3 or 4 months that went by, and I was trying to figure out what I was going to do, maybe go back to school, and that's when I was contacted by Don Dixon, and he is somebody who has a very, very positive attitude. It was the exact opposite night and day difference between what I had been through for like 2.5, 3 years. You know, my self-confidence started to come back, that I could give myself credit for being a thinking person and not just the chick stick singer in a band.
Were you expected to be that, the chick singer in the band?
Was I that in Color Me Gone?
Yeah, was that the expectation?
Yeah.
What does that mean? What does that mean?
It's tough when you're a girl in an all-guy band, first of all, just because of that woman kind of thing. When we were in the studio, too, it was a difficult situation when you feel like, and this was true, there was maybe 4 hours devoted to how the snare drum sounded, and maybe 1 hour devoted to how you could hear yourself in the headphones, me doing vocals, which was, you know, basically it is the most important thing on a record. If you've got a vocalist, that's the most important thing.
Well, you know, some men think that the woman singer is there to just dress up the band, that she's up in front to look good and add some dressing to it.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's not how I look at myself, though.
Well, I should hope.
I mean, I was even told at one point, seriously, you know, you should really wear a leather miniskirt. And by the way, get rid of that guitar. It gets in the way.
Really?
I mean, it didn't matter that I was playing significant rhythm parts that were part of the song that had to be there.
When you played clubs with the band, did you have to shout over them when you were singing?
Yeah, that's funny you should bring that up. Yeah, it was always a contest to see who could be the loudest on stage with that band. The bass player was into heavy metal, or had been before that, so he played real, real loud. And so he would insist that he had to play that loud because he had to be able to hear himself over the drums, because the drummer was like this monster, this monster drummer. And then the guitar player, of course, would say, well, I can't hear my guitar over his bass. So he'd turn up, and I just refused to compete.
I think sometimes when you're young and you're starting to sing, you want to sound like the people who you like the most. So you try to model your sound on theirs. Did you go through a period like that?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to be Joni Mitchell. And then when I started, I was playing in lounges for a long time when I was in college, just with an acoustic guitar. And then I played with a bass player named Scott Folkman, and then later on with a guy named Tom McAtee. And the three of us had a trio, and we always did cover songs. And we were doing a lot more like Carole King and Carly Simon and Linda Ronstadt and a bunch of different singers, Kim Carnes. And it was, you know, the more you sounded like the original artist, the better. Then when it came time for me to do original music, I was like, oh, no, I can't, because I don't know what I sound like. It took a long time for me to develop my own sort of voice.
The people who you used to try to imitate, do they ever sneak back into your voice when you're not paying attention?
Yeah, and those are moments of levity in the studio. Sometimes, I mean, I'll open my mouth and a real just prime Joni Mitchell note comes out, and we'll go, wait, go on. So can we... We might have to redo that because it's just too much coming through. But it's that I can't, you know, you try to be original is all. And that's the name of the game here. You try to be original.
Marty Jones, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Marty Jones' latest record, Used Guitars, is on A&M Records.
I'm going to live the dreams I've saved. If I could love somebody, if I could love
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. How are you?
Today is the one-year anniversary of the stock market crash. Are you doing any follow-ups?
That's right. Barbara Mantel in New York has been following many of the effects of that on Wall Street over the past year. We'll kind of wrap them together and tell us what a year later seems to have happened in that incredible decline of the New York Stock Exchange. Also, we'll have reports from the presidential campaigns. Governor Dukakis is touring through Ohio, trying to demonstrate warmth, and to do that in part, he has actually played the trumpet today. Done a little happy days are here again. Also, a report from the Bush campaign, and on a completely non-political subject, an interview with New York artist Eric Fischel.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In her stand-up comedy act, Roseanne Barr turns her humor on herself. While mocking her oversized frame, she also lampoons the conventional ideals of beauty and style. The self-proclaimed domestic goddess stars in a new TV sitcom that premieres this week. Our television critic David Bianculli has this review.
Let's start off with a prediction. Roseanne, which premieres Tuesday night on ABC, is going to turn out to be the most talked about and most watched TV sitcom since The Cosby Show. It's as fresh and funny now as the first episode of Cosby was back in 1984. And, like that show, it has an appealing stand-up comic at its center. The comic in this case is Roseanne Barr, whose chosen weapons are a dry delivery, poor grammar, and a very sarcastic smile. She uses them all in Roseanne, where she plays a woman named Roseanne, a woman with a semi-employed husband, three semi-bratty kids, a job at a plastics factory, and a life that is always full but not always rewarding. What makes Roseanne different is an extension and variation on what made The Cosby Show so different 4 years ago. The kids seem just as realistic, only this time they display more aggression than affection. Instead of being an upscale black family, Roseanne has a downscale white one, with a home life that's as dreary as the apartment on the Honeymooners. And the honeymooner parallels don't end there. The man and wife fight with each other and love each other just as much, and Roseanne Barr is the funniest overweight TV star since Jackie Gleason. In the pilot episode, her daughter Darlene brings home a note from her history teacher who requests a meeting with Roseanne. Roseanne gets off work, rushes to the school, and starts getting lectured by the very earnest young teacher.
How would you describe your relationship with your daughter?
Oh, I'd say it's typical.
Typical, not special.
Typical.
Do you feel you spend enough time with your daughter?
You mean like quality time?
Yes. Do you spend any free time with Darlene?
Well, I have three kids and I work, so I don't have any free time.
See, now that may be the problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the problem is that there is no problem.
Your daughter barks.
Our whole family barks.
It's her attitude as much as the jokes that makes this sitcom work. And another big plus is that John Goodman, whom you might remember from Raising Arizona, is just as funny as her husband Dan. When they talk or fight, he's just as likely to get a laugh as she is, although she usually gets the last one. It's a role reversal honeymooners only with children. Children who interrupt, who watch too much TV, and who are an inescapable responsibility. Here's a fast sampler of other moments from Roseanne's hectic home life.
What?
Can I go over to Billy's?
No, you can't go. No place for the rest of your life.
Think I can't cook? I can cook. I'm cooking.
Yeah, and I'll spend the rest of the night washing up the dishes.
Hey, I do the dishes.
When?
Thursday, 6:45 p.m.
1971. Come here, you.
What?
Well, I talked to your history teacher today.
Oh, Miss Crane, the pain.
Yeah, you're a real jokester, all right. Turn that down. She says you've been barking in class.
Yeah.
Well, what do you want to do that for?
4 years ago, the executive producers of Roseanne went to ABC with a sitcom idea that ABC turned down. That was The Cosby Show, which wound up at NBC and taught ABC its lesson. Shows like that don't come around very often, but here one comes again.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I speak with lyricist Fran Landesman, best known for her song Spring Can Really Hang You Up the Most and The Ballad of the Sad Young Men. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles his favorite 50s group, the Five Royales. In the first of a two-part profile, Ed looks back at the Five Royales' early years as a North Carolina gospel group with a new recording contract with Apollo Records. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Shah's Last Ride, William Shawcross's account of the fall and the flight of the Shah of Iran after the Islamic Revolution swept Iran. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Ed Doherty, and Lisa Bruton. Production assistance from Becky Thorne. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.